This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about charges filed on the murder of a Colombian trade unionist.
The murdered trade unionist worked for Nestlé's in Colombia. Now Nestlé's in Switzerland, the mother company, is being accused of failing to prevent his murder.
We knew that the FBI was spying on Muslim communities, but recent revelations in the Associated Press have revealed an insidious and widespread New York Police Department spying operation.
The operation includes not just New York City, but the tri-state area and universities and colleges in the Northeast. Mayor Bloomberg, instead of trying to stop this spying, has endorsed it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Heidi, I think you as well as my wife were squatters in the East Village at some point. I know my wife was many years ago, which means they took over abandoned buildings that were burned out and they sat there for housing. And of course, there's a worldwide movement of squatters. You used to go to cities in the 80s and the 70s, whether it was in Berlin or Caracas or wherever. And there's millions of squatters really all over the world. And now there's been something new going on in the East Village of New York. And I know that's where you live. So why don't you talk about what are these new initiative going on in the East Village?
Just for the record, Michael, I was never a squatter, but I had many friends who were, and I have lived in the East Village, and am happy to report that a unique museum is opening up in the East Village. It's the Museum of Reclaimed Urban Space. This is literally a living archive of how East Village community members and grassroots organizations transformed abandoned buildings and vacant lots into vibrant community spaces and gardens. Many of these efforts have spread to communities, as you said, outside the neighborhood and exist all around the world. And some of the archives for this museum are coming from the 25-year-old activist environment group Time's Up, which has a large collection of grassroots records. Did you know that at one point, approximately 500 squatters lived in 20 vacant buildings in the Lower East Side?
How many?
500. These squatters contributed an important voice to local fights against gentrification, the curfew in Tompkins Square Park, the eviction of street peddlers, the demolition of stable buildings by the city, often where squatters live. The squatters advocated for affordable housing and against the practice of warehousing, which is when landlords kept rental units vacant for long periods of time before they turned into a co-op or condo. And I think the museum is important because the input of local squatters had an enduring effect on the landscape of this community, the East Village, which cannot be underestimated. I would also like to point out that the media currently portrays activists as one-dimensional violent anarchists, and that's also how squatters were portrayed, as a kind of fringe element hell-bent on smashing the state. And as you know, during the 60s and 70s, radical political organizations such as the Young Lords, which the Guild defended, organized occupations of vacant buildings in the El Barrio as well as the Lower East Side. So this museum is going to go a long way towards setting the record straight on these negative stereotypes for future generations.
Now, what's left of squatting in the East Village, Heidi?
There are several squats left. Some of the well-known squats are Umbrella House, Bullet Space, and C Squat, where the museum is housed. That's also on Avenue C, as the name implies. And what they're doing at the museum is conducting local tours of squats and community gardens. So we'll put a link to the museum on lawanddisorder.org, and people should check it out. I've heard the tours are really fun.
Well, so when you get to New York, if you're not from New York, get to the Squatters Museum and get to the Lower East Side.
There have been recent meetings between Obama and Netanyahu. What's the update?
Well, you know, a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, are aware that Obama is supposedly, you know, not willing to bomb Iran as quickly as Netanyahu and Israel are. But there's a couple of interesting issues, sort of, they're not at the side, but related to that. One of the things that struck me was that when Netanyahu had his meeting last week with Obama, he gave him a present, a beautiful present. He gave him a book of the Jewish Bible, of the Old Testament, and it's the book of Esther. Now, anybody who's Jewish knows the book of Esther. That's the Esther was in, think about this, she was in Persia, Iran, in other words. She was in Persia, and there was a plan afoot. This is all, of course, anecdotal, but it's from the Bible, a plan afoot to kill Jews, essentially have genocide against the Jews. And Esther successfully, through a variety of means, saved the Jewish population of Persia. So the book that Netanyahu hands to Obama as his gift to show you the utter chutzpah of this small little aircraft carrier the U.S. has in the Middle East called Israel, to show you the chutzpah of Netanyahu, he hands Obama the book and said, look, this is what we were saved from last time, essentially telling Obama, you better let us go bomb the heck out of Iran because that's an existential threat to Israel. But think about that. And he gives Obama the book of the Bible. Then I went through Obama's speech to AIPAC, you know, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. And yes, he says, look, we're not going to bomb Iran as quickly, and Obama's getting all this credit. He basically says, I'm not going to wait till they have a nuclear weapon. He says, Israel wants to bomb it right now, maybe, or when it's, you know, looking at thinking about this. If they ever are capable of doing it, I'll bomb them then. So you're really talking about, you know, not huge differences, but in the context apparently of today, people are saying this is a big step. But the rest of the speech is what I found incredibly disgusting. Incredibly. It opens by talking about Shimon Peres. Shimon Peres has been the prime minister of Israel a couple of times, and he says, Obama says, I'm going to give the Congressional Medal of Honor to Shimon Peres. Well, I mean, that's the opening of the speech to AIPAC. We're giving this guy, Shimon Peres, who's supposedly now more dovish, which may be why Obama is sending some subtle message to Israel. This is Shimon Peres, who, first of all, was a member of the Haganah. The Haganah, before Israel got its, quote, independence in 48, was part of the massacre team, not maybe as bad as Yair Gun, but was in on the massacre of Deir Yassin, which was one of the most major massacres in Palestine. Then when Shimon Peres was in the government, he advocated for having settlers go into the occupied territories. Now, all of a sudden, he's a little more dovish, saying we want to settle it. But this is who Obama starts his speech with. Then he goes on to say, Shimon Peres is this hero, etc., and he made his way from Europe back home. Back home to where? He was born in Europe. He was raised in Europe as a kid. Back home to Israel. Israel as home. And so all I said in my little tweet about this was, yeah, he went home, except he was 2,000 years too late, assuming he was there at all. But so that's the second thing he says. And then Obama brags about, because he's trying to impress AIPAC, that he's this pro-Israel president. Well, we have given Israel the most defensive capability it has ever, ever had in weapons. And all I could say on that was, yeah, like defensive weapons so they could attack Gaza again, defensive weapons so they could attack the occupied territories again, defensive weapons so they can continue to kill and assassinate and imprison people. So that's our so-called Obama giving a more, what do you want to call it, Michael? I don't know. What would you call the speech?
I'd call it, I'm trying to get reelected here, guys. Don't blow my chances.
Right. That's exactly right. So we have to remember that Obama, despite claiming now to be a little more dovish in some way, did veto the resolution trying to stop settlements in the West Bank, and did say that the U.S. would veto any resolution on recognition of a Palestinian state. So this country is more than hand in glove. This country is the enabler of Israel.
He bragged about scuttling the Goldstone Report.
Oh, that's right. He did do that in the speech also.
And when he was running for office, as the Israelis were decimating the Gaza Strip and killing all those adults and 248 children, Obama sat on his hands using the excuse that Bush was the president. It's very scary, Michael and Heidi. Looks like the drumbeat for war against Iran is succeeding. Even the rhetoric of the New York Times talks about Iran's nuclear capability. And the reality of it is that they're not trying to develop weapons. They don't have weapons. They're not a threat. But Israel wants to dominate that entire area. Israel, which has not signed the non-proliferation on atomic weapons, and Israel, which itself has 400 to 600 atomic weapons, and Israel is now wants to take out Iran because it's a country of 80 million people. It's a fairly strong country. They don't want any rivals in the Middle East.
Last weekend, I joined my son Jake Ratner and the Coalition for Immokalee Workers in their hunger fast against public supermarkets in the Coalition of Immokalee Workers' efforts to get a penny a pound more for the tomatoes they pick, as well as to end abuse in the field. We'll have a full report on that next week, but if you want to read some of what people are saying about it, go to the website for Coalition of Immokalee Workers, or go to my Twitter account, which is @JustLeft, @JustLeft. If you go to that Twitter account, you will also this week see my tweets from the Bradley Manning trial. I'm going down again to Fort Meade, Maryland, to be an observer for WikiLeaks and Julian Assange of Bradley Manning's case. There'll be 2 days of hearings on the 15th and 16th of March. So if you want to follow that trial, again, @JustLeft. So, Michael, I understand we had last week a little bit of the brother man in the motherland. You were in you were in Wisconsin, where you went to law school, you went to undergraduate school, et cetera, and you were there promoting, giving lectures, et cetera, about one of the finest books to come off the American presses and English presses in years, called Who Killed Che? How the CIA Murdered Che Guevara. And I understand you were like scintillating and gave important lectures about this book. Give us a little bit of the highlights of your experience.
Well, I was on three radio shows, including WORT, which is the WBAI version in Madison, which is like one of the shining lights between San Francisco and New York. Madison, Wisconsin is,
it is amazing,
quite a hip
Madison
community. They were in the middle of their fundraiser, so they had me on, and they used our book, Who Killed Che, as their fundraiser. Then I was on Matt Rothschild's show. He is the editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine, and he has Progressive Radio Show, which goes out across the country, and he interviewed me for a half hour. And then I gave a speech at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, UWM, in the Fireside Lounge on Che. Was quite well attended. I got a handsome honorarium, which I'm going to donate to Law and Disorder. Mm-hmm. And then I gave a talk at the Rainbow Bookstore, which is the radical bookstore in Madison, founded by 60s radicals who are still running the thing. Most amazing bookstore I ever saw. There's just a tremendous collection of books. They have a black cat there named Harvey, after Harvey Goldberg, the social historian who started us off on our path. So all in all, it was a successful trip. I'm going to be giving the same speech on Che Guevara at the Left Forum, along with our friend Tito Gerassi. So I welcome everybody to come down to the Left Forum.
When is it? When is the Left Forum?
March 17th and 18th.
And that's in New York City, the Left Forum, but it's, of course, a national conference. Yeah. The dates of the Left Forum are the 17th and 18th, the weekend.
And I'm Michael Smith, and I'll be speaking on Che at, I think, 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon at Pace University. You can check it out by going online to the Left Forum. I'm also on a second panel on the terrorist attacks against Cuba and defense of the Cuban Five. We talked today about a Colombian trade union which has filed charges against the Swiss company Nestle and members of its senior management. They're accused of failing to take precautionary measures for the 2005 murder of Luciano Romero. Romero was murdered by paramilitaries in Val de Dupar, a northeastern part of Colombia. His body was found with 50 stab wounds. Romero worked for a Colombian subsidiary of Nestle called Sicolac. Sicolac is accused of being negligent in failing to prevent this crime. There's a long history of armed conflict against trade unionists and other social groups by the Colombian paramilitary forces. Romero was falsely accused of being a guerrilla fighter by Nestle's management, which also made him a target. We're joined today by attorney Wolfgang Kolick with the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights to get more information on this very important test case.
Wolfgang Kolick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
Now, I know you're calling us from Bern, Switzerland. Normally, you run European Center in Berlin. What are you doing in Bern, Switzerland?
Yeah, as the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, we are presenting cases against European transnationals who are involved in human rights violations. And yeah, one of our targets is Nestle in Switzerland, whom we try to hold accountable for an assassination of a Colombian trade unionist, Luciano Romero, in 2005.
The assassination took place in Colombia. So I know you're going to get us into what happens in Switzerland now, but let's go back for a second. The guy's murdered in Colombia. He's a trade unionist. He works for some subsidiary of Nestle or something?
Yes, yeah. As you all know, in the 2000s, we had a bloody conflict in Colombia with the paramilitaries as one of the main actors, and the region where Luciano Romero worked for a Nestle daughter was dominated by the paramilitaries. Yeah, he was the leader of the trade union, Sinaltranay, the same trade union who was also in conflict with Coca-Cola. So this trade union got into conflict not only with the company, but also with the milk producers, and the milk producers and landowners are close to or are paramilitaries. Yeah, and so in this conflict, the Nestle daughter or Nestle subsidiary in Colombia was very close to the paramilitaries. And they named the trade unions guerrilleros.
So you said the Nestle subsidiary in Colombia named the trade unionists, including Luciano Romero, right, as guerrillas. Is that it?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah, and in the context of the armed conflict in Colombia, that means that from that moment on, you're a target of the paramilitaries, because the paramilitaries, they didn't only target the armed guerrilla, which was in fact active, but also the social movements like the trade union and others. So Colombia has a record of killing over 2,000 trade unionists within the last 20 years.
Wolfgang, how do you link up the Nestle subsidiary with the murder of Romero? What facts are you going to present to make this case?
That's very interesting, because the Solidarity movement here in Switzerland was very active in the defense of the threatened trade unionists. They were threatened over years. Some of them had to go into exile. Some of them moved within Colombia. And so the Solidarity movement and the trade unions here in Switzerland tried over 3 years to make the Nestle mother company here in Switzerland move or act on behalf of the trade unionists, which they didn't do. They shifted the responsibility to their Colombian daughter. And so what we are doing is actually, kind of precedent case. We say in such cases, the mother company can be held accountable because of omission. What we accuse them is negligent killing through omission. They were in the responsibility to act on behalf of their workers, the workers who work at Nestle. They knew what happened in Colombia. They knew because of the activities of the Solidarity movement, and they didn't act.
What could they have done? It's the government, after all, and the paramilitaries.
Yeah, of
course. When the company says, what do you want us to do? What do you say?
I say, if you go into a conflict region and if you link with one of the conflict parties, you can be held accountable. Let's say they are developing new standards. We all know about the RUGI principles of which had been agreed to by the UN last year, the guiding principles for transnational companies, and that's exactly what they're saying. The companies have the duty of due diligence, and due diligence means if you go into a southern country in a conflict region, you have the task to undertake a human rights risk assessment, and then you have, as a mother company, you have also a role to play for your subsidiaries. That's new for the company. That's new for all of us. And this is why we presented the case here in Switzerland, because we're not only talking, that's serious enough, about the murder in 2005, Luciano Romero. No, we are also talking about future responsibilities of transnational companies. And this is why the whole complaint, the criminal complaint here in Switzerland, got immediately a huge media coverage, because everybody who studies the case will know that this is a problem of the present and of the future, not only of the past.
Wolfgang, is there a special Swiss law that allows you to somehow sue Nestle's in Switzerland?
Where's the jurisdiction?
For something that happened in Colombia? I know we're running into that, and we can talk about that later ourselves on the show about the problems in the U.S. on this kind of issue, but why could you go to Switzerland?
Yeah, for two reasons. One is, of course, the managers whom we're suing live in Switzerland and are Swiss citizens. That's one part of the complaint. And the other part of is the interesting part of the complaint is, if we don't get the managers hold accountable, we have as a subsidiary a measure holding the company accountable. And that's actually something exceptionary in Swiss criminal law. We don't have that, for example, in German criminal law. And
this let me slow down a little. You're saying what you have that's special in Swiss law is actually suing the corporation and not just the individuals.
Both of them. We sue the individuals, and if we cannot get hold of the individuals because of intransparency or because of a bad organization that you cannot really attribute actions to certain individuals, then in the second place you can hold the company accountable.
And that's a special Swiss law, is that it?
That's a special Swiss law, which never has applied. It's in force since 2003, but nobody tried so far to apply it to such a situation.
Now, first of all, I think you have to explain, you filed a criminal case, and that would be unusual, of course, in the United States, because we can't file criminal cases ourselves. So can you explain what that means?
Yeah, we want the criminal prosecutor here in Switzerland to undertake investigations. And we wrote a 100 pages complaint and a lot of attachments in order to convince him to start a serious investigation. And the end of such an investigation, there could be a formal accusation of the individuals and of the company.
Now,
at a trial.
Now, what's been the effect so far? I wanted you to go back to the press in Switzerland, but I also want to find out, what's the effect in Colombia at this point? The union, are they going to be subjected to more harassment?
Yeah.
What's the effect on the subsidiary? What's it done for the solidarity movement?
Okay, first of all, the interesting thing about the Luciano Romero case, as I told you, 2,000 trade unionists killed in 20 years. And one of the very, very few cases which was investigated and documented in Colombia was Luciano Romero's case. So we have two convictions against paramilitaries, the perpetrators, the direct perpetrators had been convicted in Colombia, and the judge, the Colombian judge, wrote in one decision, yet there has to be investigated the role of Nestle in this case. They never pursued this in Colombia. And this is where we come into the play. We say, look, in Colombia there is no real possibility to sue a transnational company, but this is why the Swiss judges and prosecutors have to act right now.
Nestle is a huge conglomerate. Its headquarters are Switzerland. I mean, it's got to contribute, I don't know what percentage to the Swiss economy, but we all, you know, Nestle milk products were once, of course, subject to a boycott. I mean, their baby formula, its chocolate is huge, everything. You said there's been a lot of press in Switzerland, but wouldn't it be unfavorable press? Because won't they want to protect their nice Nestle company?
We have to wait. It's always like if you come up with such a spectacular criminal complaint, lots of people are interested. Also, lots of people like us, the underdogs, who come and fight against the Goliath. But, you know, we are an experienced human rights organization. It's not because of this effect we undertake a 2 years investigation and file such a complaint. But this spectacle in the media here in Switzerland, also in Germany and other European countries, helped us, of course, put this really, really strong and serious problems on the table. So we had already talked to very serious journalists who told us, yes, you're right, this is a very interesting problem and we have no solution for it. We are in the middle of the so-called post-Ruggie process.
Yeah, you should explain that. I want you to back up because Michael and I barely understand the Ruggie process, so our listeners won't even have ever heard of it.
Yeah, we had Harvard professor John Ruggie was appointed by the UN to elaborate principles to regulate the behavior of transnational companies and human rights, and so he worked for like nearly 10 years and proposed some principles, and these principles were confirmed by the UN last year. The principles are very general, and so now in all of our countries are discussions if the law, the national law, has to be reformed in order to be in accordance with the Ruggie principles. And this is what actually is taking place right now in several countries. And so our Nestle case should be a contribution, because of course the companies, they are saying, look, we learned of all this and we are in accordance with a lot of all the our critiques. We have to do something, but you cannot regulate all this. We don't want law, we want voluntary principles. And you know, these people are sitting down and in corporate social responsibility circles and conferences and things like that. Our position as human rights organization, they may do it. Every human rights violation which is abolished by voluntary activities of the companies, that's fine enough. But there is a red line when people are damaged, when people are murdered and threatened. There, the law, the criminal law, has to play its role. And this is what we're, this is our message as well, because the companies trying to avoid red lines, trying to avoid to apply criminal law in these situations.
We're talking with Wolfgang Kolick, the director of the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, who together with the Columbia Trade Union, Sinalt Trienal, filed a case in Switzerland on behalf of a murdered trade unionist, Luciano Romero. I want to go back to the facts of Luciano Romero's killing again. He was murdered in 2005, and you have an allegation that the Colombian subsidiary called him a guerrilla, which of course opened him up with a target. But you also have an allegation in your press release. There was evidence that Sicolac, which is the subsidiary in Colombia of Nestle, made payments of some sort to paramilitaries. Can you say something about that?
One of the famous commanders of the paramilitaries, Salvador Mancuso, said this in one of his testimonies before he was extradited to the U.S. He said, to his knowledge, Nestle paid for the paramilitary troops as well. There is an indication that these payments had been made, but there are also other facts which link the Nestle subsidiary to the paramilitaries, because, as I said, some of the milk producers were paramilitaries. Some of them had been even convicted in the Colombian peace process in the last 5 years.
What kind of support are you getting in Europe for your effort and also in Colombia?
Yeah, in Colombia we are, of course, collaborating with a trade union. We are collaborating with some lawyers. In Germany, we are getting support of Catholic Church organization Miserio. A lot of journalists are interested. Swiss civil society is particularly interested in that. So we're invited to hold public events this week in Switzerland. That's all quite encouraging.
I'm interested in what the next stages are, and then for you to talk again about not just getting Nestle, but about what kind of precedent or what kind of help this is giving to accountability against transnationals.
Okay, the next step in the Nestle case is that the prosecutor got quite a difficult criminal complaint on his table, and he has to decide within the next weeks or months if he opens the procedure. And then the next step would be to go into investigations against Nestle. And that's what we're hoping for the next months. And then when he carried out the investigations, the prosecutor would have to decide either to close the case or to indict formally, yeah, some of the accused persons.
You mentioned it earlier, the precedent this kind of case can set, because you're really, as you said, at the edge of very new territory. So just talk about that for a minute, and then we can close.
Yeah, that's a company which is going to a country in the global south where a conflict is taking place has to undertake a human rights risk assessment. That's what Ruggi, the UN, and others are saying, but the companies are not accustomed to that at all. So we have to educate them to it sounds strange, human rights risk assessment, another paper, another NGO circuit built up around this company activities. But actually, it's not only writing a human rights risk assessment, it's also controlling and managing the human rights risk. And in this case, it would have meant Nestle going into a region where trade unionists are in real danger, the most dangerous countries for trade unionists. The company itself is in the responsibility to somehow develop security measures for its workers and especially for the trade unions. Of course, Nestle did the other way around because they didn't like the trade unions. The trade unions were an obstacle. But in the future, that's a clear fact. They cannot act anymore like this. And so what we are trying to do, we're trying to say to the public, or even the law which is existing now, the 2005 law, is applicable to the case, and the Nestle managers can be held accountable for the 2005 murder of Luciano Romero. Or we have to change the law, because such a case must not happen again.
Well, Wolfgang, congratulations to you, to ECCHR, the union, Sinal Trianel, for filing this. You've sent a lot of materials in many different languages, including, of course, this 100-page complaint. If our listeners want to read more about the case, can you just give us the website for ECCHR?
Yeah, it's ECCHR.eu.
ECCHR.eu. And if you want to just Google it, it's European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. Wolfgang Kallick, thank you very much.
Thank you, Wolfgang.
Thank you very much, Michael. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Much,
good work.
Wolfgang, congratulations.
We want to hear back from you later on for an update.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. See you in 3 weeks.
Okay.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
We've covered a range of stories involving the FBI spying on Muslim students and using undercover agents at mosques. Last month, news of even more widespread spying broke into the mainstream media. Revelations that the New York Police Department is spying on Muslims across the Northeast has exposed a broad spectrum of civil rights violations. Documents recently obtained by the Associated Press reveal that the NYPD has built databases showing where Muslims live, where they buy food, and even where they watch sports activities. These surveillance operations have spilled out of New York City and reached into New Jersey, Long Island, and colleges across the Northeast region. The Obama Justice Department is currently reviewing criticism of these operations. Joining us today is Cyrus McGoldrick, the Civil Rights Manager with the Council on American-Islamic Relations in New York. Cyrus, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's nothing short of astonishing, the revelations that have been coming out in the press about the secret spying on Muslim communities in New York City in cooperation with the CIA. Can you give us a sense of the scope of this problem?
Yeah, I think we're very blessed that it's no longer a secret. We now have, thanks to the Associated Press investigative reporting, we have leaked documents from the NYPD Intelligence Division itself detailing the demographics unit. This really needs more research because I'm seeing a lot of rhetoric out there about responding to threats and looking for evidence and catching the bad guys. And it's very clear when you look at the documents themselves that that's not what this is about at all. This program amounts to a comprehensive and warrantless and invasive surveillance program of all Muslim life, not just here in New York City, but even beyond the tri-state. Now we have reports now of cops going down to UPenn in Philadelphia, up to Yale in New Haven, up to Albany and Buffalo. It's pretty amazing stuff. Even worse than that, I think they were talking about NYPD officers out in North Africa and Europe and the Middle East. Really amazing stuff.
That's amazing.
This is our municipal police department going on right now. It's very troubling things, yes.
One of the things we wanted to touch on is the extent to which this has had a chilling effect on freedom of association, members of the community going to the mosques. What have you seen?
Absolutely, and this is one of the worst things that I've seen, to see people being scared out of their public activities, their constitutionally protected activities. Already, you know, we're starting to see numbers dropping at Friday prayers, people being less likely to attend mosque even for the other prayers. I think that there's absolutely a fear of speaking out, you know, speaking publicly about things. Now that we're hearing reports of a network of up to 15,000 informants feeding information to the NYPD.
Wait, in New York alone? In the New York area alone?
I believe that was the New York area alone. That was one of the early reports. I think Mother Jones cited it. And that's amazing to me because, you know, having been active in this community here in New York City for some years, there are maybe 15,000 active Muslims in this city. It's pretty unbelievable.
And do you have a sense of the profile of these informants, who they are?
That's interesting. You know, they come from different types of backgrounds. The surveillance that's being described here, that was being used by the demographics unit, were of four levels, you know, including actual undercover agents. There are some undercover agents who are put on these tasks. On the other hand, there are informants, some of them paid, some of them not, some of them pressured and coerced into informing on their communities. Very rarely are they trained, you know, for this type of work, but they go out and they take notes and they report back. Technological surveillance, there are reports of microphones, wiretaps, video cameras being placed in everything from public spaces to even schools, private Islamic schools, elementary schools, people's homes, things like that. And also just, you know, the somewhat secondary surveillance of, you know, just officers going and kind of casing Muslim neighborhoods, ethnic neighborhoods. So the informants, though, are kind of an interesting profile because, you know, we've gotten reports here at CARE New York for years about people being pressured into being informants, into informing. You know, people being approached and it being raised that they had a pending immigration status or that they had family overseas who was waiting on a visa, and this being used against them and trying to pressure them to inform. Sometimes people were being, like cab drivers, for example, were being pulled over, being given marked up tickets, you know, in order to, you know, pressure them to inform. You know, questioning would go immediately to asking, how many times do you pray? What mosque do you attend? Things like this, because this is obviously relevant to the traffic ticket that they were being written. Really amazing type of stuff that's going on out here. So the informants are it could be anybody, really. You know, they seem like to be targeting it, you know, in a Palestinian community, they'll send a Palestinian to a Moroccan community, they'll send a Moroccan to a Pakistani community, you know, et cetera. So it seems like they have enough resources that they can pretty much map the whole city and beyond.
We're talking to Cyrus McGoldrick, civil rights manager of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, and we're talking to him about the NYPD broad surveillance of the Muslim and other communities, but Muslim communities, throughout the New York area, the tri-state area, colleges, and apparently even Africa. Let me get a sense from you, Cyrus, of some of the kinds of material that they're getting from people. I understand when I read these articles, probably know better than most people read them, but, you know, what kind of sports events people go to, what kind of foods they buy. I mean, it seems like I would say it's completely nuts, except it has a really deleterious effect on the lives of human beings. So can you just talk about what kind of information they're collecting?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really important to ask that question because most media is not. They're really just lobbing up some questions for Commissioner Kelly. The shocking, not so shocking, support, you know, from the likes of the New York Post and the Daily News. You know, we have to really look at, you know, the motivation for this and the type of work that they're doing here. One of the earliest documents that came out was a PowerPoint presentation from the NYPD called the Demographics Unit. And anyone can type it into Google and you can find it for yourself. It's about 7 or 8 slides. If I remember correctly, the third or fourth slide in this document is called, the title of the slide is Ancestries of Interest. Ancestries of Interest.
Amazing.
Amazing. Like, yeah. I couldn't come up with something more sinister if I spent an hour to think about
exactly.
It.
Like, it goes back to Europe, of course,
absolutely.
In the Second World War.
Yeah, absolutely. So they on this page are 29 Ancestries of Interest. 28 of them are either Muslim majority countries or countries with, you know, sizable Muslim populations, everyone from Indonesia to Morocco. And the 29th is the American Black Muslim.
This is amazing.
Wow. Amazing. Yeah. You know, this is, you know, and anyone who tries to make the argument that, you know, they're just trying to protect us, this, they need to see this slide. There's really no way that a human being can see this and not be against it. It's really shocking stuff. And I hate pointing the fingers, too, because I am half Iranian, but I'm also half Irish, and we used to be on those lists. But this is no list of America's enemies. You know, I hate pointing the fingers at the North Koreas and Cubas of the world, you know, but this is just Muslims, basically, by ethnicity. It's the definition of racial profiling. So what they were trying to do, essentially, is map these communities. It's human mapping, community mapping, modeled off of how Israelis operate in the West Bank. Now, types of information like, we have reports. They went into Newark, for example, and on also Long Island, they did similar reports, 60-page reports on every Muslim-owned business and institution in those areas. I think it was Gawker put up a great article calling it the NYPD's Zagat Guide for Halal Restaurants.
Wow, that's it's like, funny, except that it's not that funny.
Exactly.
Right?
You have to laugh sometimes just to stay sane. But types of details were in the report like, oh, they were watching Al Jazeera on TV, or there was a donation box for the local mosque. There was a African-American guy named Musa working in the back. Like, these are the types of things that they were detailing. You know, you guys are the lawyers here, but to be opening up files on people and to be, you know, surveilling the political speech of people with absolutely no evidence of any crime being committed, essentially Muslim until proven innocent, really, it really makes me scared as an American to see, you know, how they're using the fear of Islam to just erode all of our rights one by one.
Let's talk about Mayor Bloomberg's reaction.
Let's.
A little bit of disdain, defensiveness perhaps, saying that police were only following leads, that the actions were appropriate. How do you respond to that?
I'd love to believe them, but it's just not true. Like, I really wonder, you know, what world these guys live in. The documents are there. Like, they're online. They're NYPD documents. We've seen them for ourselves. Like, I would love to put Mayor Bloomberg in front of the PowerPoint presentation, the demographics unit, and let him justify that, because there's no way. The way that they get around this is by just completely lying, or okay, maybe let me give them the benefit of the doubt. I'd like to hope they were misinformed, but there's no way at this point. Confirmations of what the community already knew came out in August of last year. This report with the demographics unit PowerPoint presentation was, if not late August, early September. Now, there's no excuse for justifying this type of activity. But what they do, and I don't understand why for Mayor Bloomberg, honestly, because, you know, I understand the political pressures on certain people, you know, some mayoral candidates and even national politicians, you know, to just categorically support, you know, the targeting of Muslims. It's pretty popular to do that these days. But I can't understand why Mayor Bloomberg, who's really accountable to no one and who, you know, isn't running for another election, you know, why he wouldn't make the moral choice here. There's just really no excuse for it. But it seems they just redirect the questions, that they'll, you know, just wave the bogeyman. You know, they'll trot out pictures of guys they've convicted of terrorism and say that this is what we're keeping you safe from. And unfortunately, at least by the last poll, maybe we're not doing our job on outreach, but unfortunately, a slight majority of New Yorkers agree with them.
Cyrus McGoldrick, you gave a written statement to the Senate Standing Committee on Veterans, Homeland Security, and Military Affairs, and in it you cited a statistic from a recent study from Duke University and University of North Carolina, which I thought was astounding. Of all the crimes in the country, last year there were some 10 arrests for terrorist activities. It seems to me that the problem is probably slightly less than the problem of being injured by a bee sting. Yet they've made this huge thing about it. And I wanted your reaction to that statistic.
Absolutely. It's amazing. Yeah, I mean, Professor Kurzman down there, Charles Kurzman down there has been doing great work and just completely just undermining the rhetoric, you know, that is coming out of the police department, you know, ever since the report that they released in 2007, Radicalization in the West, which basically made the case that you could tell based on someone growing a beard, frequenting a mosque, quitting smoking, and giving up urban hip-hop clothing, that person was radicalizing. You know, this type of work, you know, by Charles Kurzman and Robert Pape from UChicago, you know, has really shown what the facts are about this stuff. It's really important to remember. Seriously, I think you're right. It's not even a joke that literally you're more in danger of bees, of honeybees, than you are of a terrorist attack in the city. And don't let the NYPD tell you that that's because they're spying on college students from Philadelphia to New Haven, because that's not the case. There's maybe two cases of terrorism where the FBI was not the primary planner of that attack. And they were, you know, Faisal Shahzad, this Times Square car bomber idiot, and there's a guy who tried to blow up his underpants on an airplane. These
I know.
People, like, they didn't find them, mind you, by playing James Bond in prayer rooms and, you know, creeping on people's political conversations in coffee shops and, you know, hanging out at Utah Fried Chicken in Newark, New Jersey. That's not how they found these guys. It was because they found suspicious behavior in public. They caught them going through. And actually, let me remind you, in the case of Faisal Shahzad, it was a Muslim street vendor who called the police when he saw a smoking car.
Right.
That's a very underreported fact. I hate to sometimes even stoop to this argument because, you know, I like to foster a society that appreciates its constitutional values and respects them above all else. But even look at this from the perspective of effective policing. And in a city where we have limited resources, where we're shutting down schools and cutting social services, to be paying officers and informants to be sneaking around college campuses and our restaurants and listening to every sermon and every mosque within 250 miles of New York City, which was the goal. This is, it's really embarrassing, to say the very least, you know, that my taxpayer dollars are going so that the NYPD can probably record the call that I'm on with you right now.
It's true. Probably, Cyrus.
Right. Cyrus, in one of the articles, the term rakers was used, and we didn't know what that was.
Well, there were two. There were rakers, but the other word...
Mosque crawlers.
Mosque crawlers. You might as well talk about mosque crawlers as well. But Heidi, we both were sitting there. What's a raker?
So the rakers, I believe, are those who are sent into communities to rake for, quote-unquote, hot coals. So they will basically just, just go through the community and just kind of, you know, comb the whole community. You know, I'm thinking of the imagery from Spaceballs.
So was I. When you said it, I thought of Woody Allen when he's looking for the woman he likes in there, and he says, comb the desert. And then a giant comb comes out that's like 40 feet long, and they actually literally comb the desert. Right?
Yeah.
It's a great scene.
And Ray Kelly is Darth Vader.
He's got a hairdryer.
Like, that's exactly what's going on in every ethnic community within 250 miles of New York City. You know, they are sending people, just a shocking number of informants and sometimes undercover officers, just culling, you know, political speech and religious activities, hearing what people are talking about. You know, they would talk about, actually, it was interesting. You know, it seems like they had at least a little bit of consciousness about what pissed Muslims off. Something would happen in foreign policy, where, like, when Israel bombed and massacred people in Gaza a couple of years ago, or when the U.S. assassinated American citizen Anwar Awlaki in Yemen with no court proceedings. You know, they knew that this would make people mad, you know, that this would make people upset. So then they would increase, you know, the surveillance. They would increase, they would flood the neighborhoods that they felt would be most affected, and then listen even closer. So they're basically just listening to everything that they could, you know, watching everything that they could, and just looking for, you know, anyone who might be expressing some anger. You know, that might be, you know, raising a dissenting voice. That's what the rakers were. The mosque crawlers played a similar role. That's, you know, they definitely belong in the same sentence. It's just more specific. But rakers, I think, are the more general term for the invasion, the infiltration of this community. And it's interesting because early on, Deputy Commissioner, the spokesman, Paul Brown, mocked this. He mocked us when we raised reports about this, when we raised concerns about this, these reporting by the AP, you know, talking about, oh, this is just a big fiction, mosque crawlers and rakers, this is like the stuff of a fantasy, I think was something, that was his quote was something like that. Sure enough, got caught in a lie again. Deputy Commissioner Brown, I noticed he's being a little bit more measured in his statements because he's been caught lying so many times.
Yeah, he was caught lying on the third jihad, right, on that film.
Badly.
Saying it wasn't shown to anybody or six people, and then, of course, 1,200 people, et cetera.
Even worse than that, he said very explicitly that Commissioner Kelly did, and the NYPD did not participate in the production of the film, and that Commissioner Kelly's interview for the third jihad was just pulled from another source. Turns out within 24 hours, the producer of the third jihad actually emailed the New York Times, who this interview was given to, and said, oh, why did he say that? I have the email here where they agreed to a 90-minute exclusive interview with us in One Police Plaza. And we have the whole footage and the confirmation. And then all of a sudden, Paul Brown remembered.
Paul Brown is the city spokesperson for the police department.
Unbelievable. So, Bloomberg, I have to say, Mayor Bloomberg's defense of him after that was classic. He said, no, Paul Brown is as trustworthy as anyone who's entrusted, who is tasked to distribute information for the city of New York. If I were another spokesman for another department in New York, I would have been mortally offended by that.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You underscored that. They know what angers Muslims in America. Yeah. Right. Killing 1,100 people in Gaza was one right. such effort, or right. extrajudicially assassinating an American citizen was another. They know that, and we know that. But right. what they say is that there's some irrational hatred that Muslims have because they hate the United States, you know.
They just think
we're evil. So for the public, you know, they don't admit what the reality is.
Right, absolutely.
Let me ask about a related question. To what extent is CIA involved in here? Is there a national thing? And to what extent is this going on across the country? I know it's really bad here. We had someone on, I guess I'm sure you're familiar with it, in Southern California where they were going through mosques as well.
Right.
But can you just give us some sense of both CIA stuff as well as overall?
No, very, very important questions. Because, you know, I think in this case, we're just lucky that we have the reports at all. We're lucky that this got discovered, because it certainly would have been going on without our knowledge. And even when you look at the responses of the police commissioner, you know, they don't even bother denying anything anymore. They just defend it. So I have no reason to believe that they would have stopped. The involvement of the CIA has been very interesting. It was David Cohen from the CIA who came to the NYPD after 9/11. Sometimes they refer to him as a former CIA agent. I'm not sure that's the type of club that you can leave. So that concerns me a little bit. But, you know, I mean, his paperwork seems to be in order. There were other CIA agents who were actually posted that were on CIA payroll but were posted in the NYPD.
Really?
Now, yes.
Wow, I didn't know that at all.
They're not supposed to do that, are they?
Yeah, and they're not allowed to do that, and they know that. So the inspector general, it's actually interesting, this chain of events, because the inspector general at the CIA actually conducted an investigation into the CIA's involvement in this program, allegedly. Came back and said, nope, we didn't do anything wrong. Thanks for trying. You know, so of course, you know, I don't really expect lawyers being paid by the CIA to, you know, investigate the CIA, but regardless, later, like within a couple months, maybe 2 months ago, the CIA actually removed the officers that were at the NYPD because of a lack of supervision, they called it. You know, I don't know if we can credit exclusively our own rabble-rousing about this issue, but I'm certainly glad that it happened. The issue of the national level is absolutely relevant because, you know, if the NYPD is doing it, I'm not even sure that they are the precedent that's being set, but they're certainly trying. I imagine that the FBI is doing this comprehensively as well. There are recent reports the ACLU had done some good work on finding documents showing that even their community outreach events were being used for intelligence gathering. Not a big shock to civil rights advocates, but certainly a blow to their efforts at creating a facade of cooperation. And I think, especially you mentioned LA, I think that's why you see a lot of the usual suspects lining up to defend the NYPD tactics. We used to had a recent op-ed published in the New York Post by former governor, but also Homeland Security head Tom Ridge, James Woolsey from the CIA, just categorically defending everything that Ray Kelly was doing, rejecting calls for oversight over them, and then basically they just resorted to anti-care talking points the whole time. Like, it was just such a rag of an op-ed. I was shocked. When you see these people lining up to defend this, you have to wonder why. And I really do believe that they think if they can defend this program now, while, you know, this country is scandalized over it, you know, then they'll be going to be able to only increase it here on out.
Cyrus, given the outrage, we're surprised there hasn't been more protest in the streets against this broad-based
right.
surveillance.
Right.
Why is that?
I've been wondering the same thing.
I think, sure.
I know I'm kind of inclined to be out there myself, but I think that in some respect there's a desensitization in the city about it. I think Muslims, especially once the stories came out about the student spying, certainly a lot more people stood up. But I think early on a lot of people were just scared. You know, they didn't want to speak out very loudly against it.
Yeah.
Some people, unfortunately, there's this idea, you know, that there is if I have nothing to hide and I'm well-educated and I'm just living my life, that, you know, I have nothing to worry about, which also is not true.
No, I know that's true in the Muslim community, but and I know you work for a Muslim organization,
sure.
But as an outsider here, from at least not being a Muslim, I'm really shocked by the reaction in the city.
Right,
I am floored. I mean, it's the most open, comprehensive attack
right.
on Muslims
yeah.
that I can remember, and
right.
the silence, if not worse, the endorsement
Doubting
by our city
it.
Officials, I'm completely...
Yeah.
shocked by it. And
I
don't know what to say. I mean, it's just like I'm just flabbergasted. Why don't you give people some sense of how to get more materials from you at CARE and what kind of actions you're advocating people to
right.
take?
You can find us at care-ny.org. That's C-A-I-R. We're the New York chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, and I'm pretty easy to find. You can always contact me if we can be of any service. You know, on this material, definitely look up the Associated Press reports. You know, you can go to ap.org/NYPD and see all of the documents right there firsthand. You know, you don't have to take it from people like me. You know, we're blessed to still have access to the internet, hopefully for a little while longer, and I hope that you can see these things for yourself. You know, we want to protect people. We want to let them know what their rights are, and we're going to continue that type of efforts. So you can invite us to do one of those events anytime. We encourage you to contact your elected officials, encouraging Congress to and encouraging Holder to investigate this, and City Council really needs to demonstrate some political will here to rein in this police department as well. So definitely make sure that you're ready to vote this year and next year. And remember that when you talk about this and then when you raise awareness about this, remember that this is not a Muslim issue. That this is an American issue and a human issue, because they're using the fear of us to get to your rights. Not only can they spy on you, they can now indefinitely detain you. They can convict you without evidence. They can torture you in prison. It's really unbelievable the amount of the assumptions of power that the government has justified with the war on terror. And this is a war on terror that's now being brought to our homeland.
Cyrus, thank you so much, and we hope to stay in touch with you on this crucial issue.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Cyrus, you're terrific.
Take it easy, Cyrus. Good work.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.